Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Academic Life, a podcast for your academic journey and beyond. I'm the show's producer and the show host, Dr. Christina Gessler, and today we are joined by Dr. Elba Iris Perez to talk about her debut novel, The Things We Didn't Know. The Things We Didn't Know is a cross-cultural coming-of-age story about a young girl's childhood between 1950s Puerto Rico and a small Massachusetts factory town. Andrea Rodriguez is 9 years old when her mother whisks her and her brother Pablo away from the tiny factory town that is the only home they've known. With no plan and no money, she leaves the family in the mountainside villages of Puerto Rico and promises to return. Months later, when Andrea and Pablo are brought back to Massachusetts, they find their hometown significantly changed. As they navigate the rifts between their family's values and all-American culture, they face the realities of growing up and must embrace triumphs and heartaches that mark the journey to adulthood. The Things We Didn't Know is Dr. Perez's debut novel. Welcome to the show, Dr. Perez.
Hello. I'm very happy to be here.
I am so glad that you're here and that we are going to talk about this novel that kept me up very late last night. But before we get into that, will you please tell us about yourself?
Oh, well, sure. I am a writer. But I spent the first 26, 27 years of my professional life teaching theater at the University of Puerto Rico in Arecibo. And then I did a doctorate degree in history, kind of focused on Puerto Rican theater. And then my husband got a job in the United States, and we decided to come here so that he could further his, you know, professional goals. And so I quit doing theater, which I loved, and I thought I would never, ever live without doing theater. But we came here, and I found myself all alone in a house while he was away working, and I started writing. So now I'm a writer.
So you say a bit about that in the acknowledgments about the journey you went on to be a writer. It's a lot of work to write and to get support for writing. Do you want to talk about that process?
Sure. Well, in addition to, you know, that professional journey, I have two kids. They're both adults now. And so, you know, family and life gets in the way or becomes a part of the journey, right? Of the writing journey. And so I have to say that when I started writing, I thought that because I had written a thesis, and, you know, as a professor, you write a lot of things, you know, that I knew what it was like to write a story and that, you know, that I could do it. I was just very laid back about it. And so I started writing this story, but I really didn't know what I was doing. I just kept rambling on and on and on. And I went to a conference and met an editor, Marcela Landres, and I sent her my manuscript and asked her, you know, for feedback. And she said, "Elba, you have talent, but you don't know anything about writing a novel." And so that's how my writing journey started. That was just the beginning.
I'm glad she started with "you have talent" first, because if she had flip-flopped the order of that sentence, I don't know that you would have written the book.
Exactly. Exactly. That's a really important point, because it's really important for people to know people, especially in the publishing industry, that one sentence, one word can change the destiny of a writer, you know? It can be crushing to hear, you know, just one word can make you feel so inadequate that you would not move on.
We build up our armor as academics, and sometimes we hide behind our research. We say that we have objectivity, that we have all of these sources that, you know, we're quoting, and we keep imagining ourselves many steps away from how attached we really are to our output. But when we go into our creative writing, we don't really have that facade anymore to assure us that we are not as attached to our work as we think we are.
Yes, you're right. And that is part of what I think made this journey very interesting, because just to go back a little, before I started writing the novel, I grew up in Warrenoka, a place in Massachusetts, which is very isolated. And this is where the idea of the novel comes before I get into the writing process. And when I was 12 years old, I went back to Puerto Rico. I'm Puerto Rican. And my father stayed there because he worked at a paper mill. I returned to Puerto Rico with my mother. They separated. And many years later, about 20 years later, I came to the United States and decided to go to Warrenoka to see what had come of that place. My father no longer worked there. And I had heard that the houses had been torn down. And when I went there, this was in 2002, it was just incredible, you know, to go to a place where you lived and had so many experiences, and just to see that it's torn down, only the land is there, the place is there, but no sign of the past. And I came across a couple of people while I was there and asked them if they knew that there had been a Puerto Rican community there. And they looked at me like, you know, who are you? What are you talking about? And so that is where the idea of writing the novel came from. And so I started looking up people who had lived in Warrenoka. And they all agreed to interviews. And so I said, yay, I'm going to write this history book about the Puerto Ricans who came to live in Warrenoka and work at that paper mill. And wouldn't you know it, one by one, they all passed away. And so I couldn't, you know, that my project was shot. And then this happens where my husband gets a job in the U.S. and we move here, and I'm all alone in my house. And one day I start thinking of this character and imagining this character in Warrenoka. And that's how I started writing. But the point I'm trying to make is that you can know how to write in a genre, or say as a historian, but to write a novel is a totally different animal.
It really is. And so you took some writing classes too, correct?
Right. And so when Marcela Landres told me that I didn't know what writing a novel was about, you know, I had no idea, you know, what it was like to develop a character and a plot. You hear that from the professors in the English and languages departments, right? But to do it is a whole nother thing. And so she suggested that I take classes at UCLA in their online program. And the writer's extension program at UCLA. And then so I did.
It's amazing how these things come about. In some ways, reading the book, I wondered if it was an imagining of if you had stayed. The story in the novel is almost flip-flopped from the personal narrative that you just shared of how your life actually worked out.
It is. It's as if I wrote what would have happened if I had stayed in Warrenoko, you know, because I lived there until I was 12 and returned to Puerto Rico. But the main character in The Things We Didn't Know is in Warrenoko her whole life.
You talk about your family at the in the acknowledgments, and there's a strong thread of family here in the book. Did when the family read the book, did they try to figure out what character they were?
Yes, that has been so funny because they ask, is this character Aunt so-and-so, Aunt Justina, or Aunt Octavia? And I'm like, you know, no, no. What I did was that I created, well, first of all, you know that doing recent history is very difficult for many reasons, but one reason is that everyone's alive and you don't want to offend people, you know. And so I struggled with that when I was going to write the history. And I thought, well, I will just keep it, you know, to the workers and what their life was like. But then when I started writing the novel, I was like, well, who would the characters be? I can't write real characters. And I thought, well, will this be an autobiography, a memoir? And then I said, no, why don't I just make it all up? So the way I created these characters is that I imagined them living there like they would have been my neighbors.
And we see more of the family coming over from Puerto Rico as the book goes on. Our main character, Andrea, she briefly goes to Puerto Rico when her parents split up. So it's a flip-flop of your personal story. But then she comes back and then more family comes over. And then we see the town kind of shrivel up. There's a strong out-migration. It's sort of a stopping point where people build up their financial capital so they can move onward.
Right. Yes. That's what it was like. It wasn't a place where I think one of the characters, Socorro, says that Warrenoko is not a place where you want to stay.
But as a kid, did you feel like it was?
I did, yes. And most of the kids did. Because it's this forest. It's a wilderness. And right in the middle of this wilderness, this paper mill is plopped right in the middle, right next to a river and this waterfall. So that is like heaven for kids. We just ran around on our bicycles, went up and down the hills, ran along the banks of the river. The older kids dove into Salmon Falls. It was just marvelous. So for the kids, we never wanted to leave Warrenoko.
There's so many questions I want to ask you, and I want to be mindful of the time. We've been talking about how the book came to be. Can you sort of give the elevator pitch for the listeners who might not have heard about the book yet?
So this is a coming-of-age story. It's a multicultural story, and it is set in the 1950s, starts in the 50s and goes through to the 70s. And it's set in Puerto Rico and in Woronoco, which is a very small, tiny village in the mountains of Massachusetts.
And while it's sort of isolated, it also is not that far from some college towns. As the kids in the book get older, they start talking about different colleges that they want to go to in Massachusetts. And you get the sense that if one has a car, then the world becomes more accessible.
Right. Right. Yes. It's not that isolated. It is if you don't have a car. But the closest town is about 7 miles away. So if you have a car, you know, everything's close by.
We get a sense as the kids get older in the book that they all begin making their plans about how they're going to leave town too. Yes. And yet our main character, she doesn't want that.
She does. But she is a very obedient person. She's trying to please her father, and, you know, in Hispanic culture, women don't leave their home until they get married or they go off to college. And at that time, in the 50s, not all Hispanic parents wanted their daughters to go to college. So, yeah, Andrea wants to leave and live a life of her own, but she has to come of the age of doing that. The other kids, as soon as they're teenagers, you know, 12, 13, 14, they're looking for ways to get out, hitchhiking. Somebody gets a car at 16, you know, and they can all jump in and go to the nearby towns. But my main character, Andrea, can't do any of that because of the very strict father she has.
She wants to be a teacher, so she knows she has to get out. But there's also this sadness she has when she watches different people leave. Friends move away, relatives move away. And I think maybe that's what I meant about she doesn't want the leaving part of it.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that is her home to her. So, you know, she is attached to it like we all are to our hometown. Yes, it's very sad when people move away and she doesn't see a way out except for going to college.
When you came back and you realized that the town wasn't really there anymore, was that kind of melancholy almost, is that part of what imbues the book?
Yes, of course. Of course. I looked at around, you know, and thought, what would it have been like to have stayed here? You know, I left when I was 12 and I met a whole country, you know, Puerto Rico. And I was exposed to, you know, everything out there in the world and went to college. And Andrea is stuck in Woronoco her entire life until she goes off to college. And so that I wanted to capture what that does to people. There are other characters who leave before they're ready to leave, you know, and they don't have very good experiences.
There are so many forces coming to bear on the main characters. Part is that many of the main characters that you focus on have moved there from another country. Even some of her school friends, the families have immigrated from Canada.
Right. Right.
And then we have the way that these mill towns were set up. This is a paper mill, and all of these people have good, stable housing, safe housing, but you can't own your housing. You can't own the land the house is on, and they haven't brought in any support businesses as the owners of this whole property. They haven't brought in restaurants, right, or small shops. And so And then there's the fact that if they want to go to church, they have to go quite far away. And so there are so many forces coming to bear on these people and their sense of how they can make choices.
Right. You're right about that. It's there isn't anything there but the post office and a little penny candy store on the side of the post office. And then the company built, and I'm talking about the real war in Oko. That's what it was like. And then the company built this place that they called the club, and they would teach, they would bring in someone to teach gymnastics to the kids. And once in a while, they would have dance parties for the teenagers. I never got to that because I left at 12 and I was not allowed to go to any of that. But yeah, there was not much there to do except, you know, we would be running around with sticks in our hands looking for frogs and whatever we could come across in the wilderness.
In reading the acknowledgement, it sounds like you were able to connect up with some Facebook groups or some people on social media who could fill in what it was like to have been a teenager there during that time, since you were not.
Yes. And that's a very sad thing right now for me, because about a week ago, somebody hacked my Facebook and it was deactivated and suspended. And I have lost contact with all those people. But I had the most beautiful experience of having these people who went to school with me in elementary school, okay, from Woronoco get in touch with me through Facebook. And that has been fascinating, you know, to remember these faces and to see them now, 40 years ago, you know. And yes, I asked a few of them, you know, what their life was like, because they stayed there. And that helped me a lot with recreating life in Woronoco after I left and figuring out what my main character would be doing.
You also give your main character a brother, and we see similarities between his path and Andrea's, and yet quite a lot of differences. What inspired the character of the brother and his trajectory?
So you're saying that there are differences between his path and Andrea's path?
It right? seems so, reading it, that he feels he can make more rebellious choices. He feels safer to make different kinds of friends than she does. And he has a different sense of his role in the inside the home and within the small family group that they've built amongst the neighbors.
Right. Well, part of it is the fact that he's a male, you know. He's a boy. And so, you know, in Hispanic culture, you know, men have a lot more freedom than women do. Women are supposed to be in the house and the men are, you know, can come and go. And so he's growing up with that sense of macho, right? That Andrea would never have. So that's part of it. That is a very important character for me. It was very important for me to work through that character. When I wrote this novel, there were two things that I wanted to write about, and I didn't want to make them personal. But there are themes that I wanted to develop and explore and share with the world. One was what it is like to grow up with a single parent, a male single parent because my father practically raised me. And because in my personal life, my parents divorced when I was very young, and I stayed with my father. So I wanted to work with that idea, you know, because there's always this stereotype around that Latino men and Black men are not good fathers. They abandon their wives, they abandon their kids, they move on, and they don't even provide child support. And every time I hear things like that, I think of my father, and I say, I would say to myself, damn, you know, my father loved us so much and really struggled to raise us by himself. So I wanted to work that character. And the other one is that we are six brothers and sisters, right, in my personal life. There are six of us. And one of my brothers has struggled with mental illness. And so I wanted to, you know, work through that too, because we have to talk about these things. So I thought those two parts of my life, somehow I wanted to weave them into this story.
The father character and the brother character seem to be conflicted in themselves, however, about what they want for her and what might be traditional. You know, the father is really encouraging her to get her college education and saying, you can't live your life dependent on a man. So if anything ever goes wrong, if you have your college degree, I know you can always look after yourself.
Right.
And her brother, even as he is sneaking out and doing things, that he has more freedom because he's a boy, doesn't seem to understand that she feels she doesn't, because he'll say, you can do this too, and I can figure out what to say to dad, and we can get away with these things. So there's this interesting pushback, even with the brother and the father, against tradition, even as they're trying to look after her. I feel the sense that they're worried about how to guide her.
Right. And yes, that has a lot of, you know, you can look at that in many ways. You know, like, first of all, the father is a countryman. He worked on a farm. He had a farm in Puerto Rico. And so he has a very medieval kind of peasant kind of way of looking at what women should and or should not be doing. But then he's in the United States and he's seeing, you know, that women can go to college, women can, you know, do other things. So he's, one part of him is thinking, well, my daughter's probably just gonna get pregnant and get married one day. Why send her to school? But then he's also, you know, struggling with the fact that, hey, you know, women can also go be professionals. And then her brother, Pablo, he is growing up in the United States. And so he is seeing all the girls around him. They're all talking about going to college, you know, and moving on away from Orinoco in their lives. So he's also wanting his sister to be on par with everyone around them. So it's this cultural struggle, tension. It's like a tension more than a struggle that I'm constantly trying to infuse the story with.
And in the background is the start of the Vietnam War, and they have a TV set and they're seeing news about race riots, and she's trying to explain things to her dad, and they're kind of, the main character and her brother seem to be a bit more progressive than their dad, but he seems to be trying to figure out what all of this will mean for their future and guide the brother towards avoiding the draft.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm trying to portray some of what many of us faced in the 50s and 60s during the Vietnam War. Absolutely. You know, some people were adamant, you know, my son is going to, you know, fight for this country. And other people were saying, no, I'd rather send my son to Canada. You know, I remember that. So yes, they're watching this on television unfold.
When you write something like this, it's so vivid how it came through. You bring us scents and sounds and smells. Were you drawing from your own personal memory in the ways that you wanted to evoke feeling and sensory experiences?
Yes, and thank you for pointing that out. Yeah, that's a complicated experience. I guess everyone has to find their own way of doing that. But I plop myself imaginary, right in an imaginary way. I try to plop myself right in the center of what I'm writing and pause, you know, and try to listen to what you would listen to in that place, what you would hear, what sounds there would be around you, and what taste you might have in your mouth, and what smells would be around you. And so I started remembering the lilac bushes, the peach trees, you know, the poison sumac trees, which had these bright red fronds. And so you start remembering, and some of it you make up and some of it comes from memory.
One of the characters who's very important to our main character is the aunt. Both Pablo and Andrea accept her immediately, but their mom and their dad both struggle to come to acceptance of this character. Can you bring us into the importance of their aunt and why you've portrayed her in this story?
Well, first of all, you need an antagonist in a story. And I struggled trying to find at different points in the story, what is it that the character wants and what is stopping her from getting it, right? And, you know, you constantly have to be watchful of that. You can't just ramble on, you know, sitting on the couch eating ice cream and watching television. There, some things have to happen. And so at some point I started to have these memories of people who were not very nice to kids throughout my life. And so I took all of that and infused it into one character. So she's really bad. And I thought it was very important. It was necessary to bring a character like that into this story and out into the world, because it's important for people to remember or find out for the first time that a few decades ago, the way children were treated was very different from the way children are treated now. Kids had no rights, basically, you know? It was an okay thing to hit a child, and it's quite an issue now. In fact, a child can pick up the phone and call Child Protective Services, call the police, you know, and complain about their parents, where that was completely unheard of in the 50s, 60s, and probably in the 70s. So the whole way that we look at children now has moved forward in positive ways, away from these ways that children were treated in the past. So I wanted to bring that in, and I gathered all of these different characters from real life and created this one evil character.
She's trying to teach Andrea about these ideas of respectability and how to, she could one day be a perfect wife or mother, things that young Andrea isn't even really looking ahead to yet. And she's learning them through really physically difficult ways, using bleach until her hands are red and scrubbing socks until they bleed. And this aunt, I think her name literally means perfect,
right?
Does it?
Yeah.
And yet her methods are cruel. And then we have this other aunt who is in some ways the family outcast, who is so lovable. And we see her trajectory happening at a time of the background of civil rights, which also include fights for gay and lesbian rights.
Oh, yes. That is... That is a favorite character of most people. So,
can you share more about her?
Sure. I wanted to say about Perfecta, though, before we go on to Cecilia, that Perfecta, you know, as all of us in life, is not totally bad, right? There are some good traits about her too, because you can't create a character that is totally, completely bad. It would be too unrealistic. But anyway, the lovable aunt is, that is a character that I created completely out of my imagination. Because when the children return to Puerto Rico in the novel, Andrea and Pablo are taken to Puerto Rico with their mom. When I first wrote that part of the story in the first draft, I had created characters of a grandmother and grandfather that Andrea and Pablo stay with. And that's where they were in Puerto Rico. And then on one occasion, you know, as a historian, I had these memories of a professor of mine saying that when you read a story, a history of the past, of the more remote past, you don't find Blacks, women, the common day man, children. That history has been written mainly about kings and queens and wars and the economy, politics. And he said this. He said, you know, you have to imagine all of the people that are left on the borders of the page, looking into the story, reading it, and never seeing themselves represented in the story. And this one day, I remembered Dr. Fernando Picón talking about that, and I said, oh my God, what am I doing? When they return to Puerto Rico, you know, Puerto Ricans are Black, brown, white, Indian. I have created this character of these two, of these grandparents who are white. And there are so many grandparents in Latino literature. What am I doing? I need to create a different character, a character that is not common, that needs to be represented. This is, you know, the 2021, 2020, you know, what am I doing? And I said, they're not going to stay with their grandparents. It's going to be an aunt. And then I thought, she has to be Black. And then I was thinking, well, she can't be Black because they're white. Well, I'm going to make her Black. I'll figure that out later. And I just kept doing that until I came up with this character who is Black, lesbian. She's overweight. She's not very pretty. And I said, yeah, that's the character I want. You know, I'll work with her. So that's how that lovable aunt came to life.
She comes back into the story, though. They lose touch with her. And then she comes back when they most need her, almost like a fairy godmother character. She seems to be able to show up for them exactly when they need her the most.
Yes. Yeah. That's what you can do when you're writing a novel, right? You can make things up.
We're starting to run out of time. Are there things you'd like to highlight for the listeners that we didn't have a chance to talk about yet?
Well, I would just like to say that we all have talent. And if you're interested in writing, work really hard. Learn everything about writing that you can. And just be persistent and keep working. I think that's the best thing to say to authors, right? Keep working and learn everything you can.
What does your writing practice look like?
I am fortunate that my husband works from home. And so I am home every day and I get up and have breakfast and go out for a walk and then come home and write every day. So I'm very fortunate to have the opportunity to do that.
When you wrote this novel, it became part of a contest, is that right?
Yes. I wrote it and submitted it, and I submitted it to like 15 agents and did not get any response. And then one day I saw this announcement in, it was either Writer's Digest or Poets and Writers, one of those magazines. And it was for diverse writers. And I thought, well, what does that even mean? Because, you know, I've lived most of my life in Puerto Rico, and we don't use that word there the way it's used here. And then I figured out, well, I'm Puerto Rican, so I guess I do fit that label. And I sent it in and it won, which is still something that shocks me. But yes, it won that contest, the Books Like Us first novel, Simon & Schuster contest.
Writing can be a slow process with lots of starts and stops. So I was wondering, you shared earlier on that when you first had a draft, you had an editor or agent who was willing to take a look at it. And they came back with a statement that you had talent, but you hadn't mastered how to write a novel.
Right.
I'm wondering how long the timeline was from when you started working on this project to when we reached the release of the book in 2024.
Well, it took me a total of 10 years to write the novel and get it published. But the editor that told me to go to UCLA and take classes, that was 4 years before it got
of classes.
Published. Yeah, before I got published. The class was a year. It was 2 semesters.
I think it's helpful to know these things because when we hold a book in our hands, we think, oh, this person, it just flowed for them, or they just knew how.
No.
And we seldom get to peel back that curtain and right. Hear about how it really is.
Right. And that's why I say to writers, learn everything you can. Because I had a doctorate in history, and here I was and taking online classes at UCLA to learn how to write a novel. You can't just expect to know how to do this. There is a way of writing, a novel, just like there's a way of writing poetry. And the more you learn, the more confidence you'll have, and the more creative you will become, because then you know what to do with that creativity, how to put it into this mold, which is a book called a novel.
Has this process inspired you to write another novel?
Absolutely. I'm right in the middle of my second novel, which is a romantic kind of fantasy. So yes, of course, the whole point is to make a career out of this. And, you know, you use what you have learned to say more and do more and reach more people.
Thank you so much for being here today. What do you hope listeners take away?
Well, I hope they take away that this is a story that does give you a really good sense for what children go through when they are displaced. And, you know, how much of a struggle it is to find your place in the world when you move from one country to another. And so this applies to anyone, really, who has moved even from one neighborhood to another. So I think diving into this novel brings you a good sense of the drama in a child's life that displacement can cause.
Dr. Elba Iris Perez, thank you so much for sharing the things we didn't know.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Academic Life here. Please join us again.
Thank you.